From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's our Week in Review. We'll touch in on the local primary races and analyze the scandals within the Catholic Church.
Do you notice the beautiful words that the Pope spouts consistently? We apologize, we're appalled, we're astonished. We never have gotten a plan from Pope Francis about how to clean this up.
And 50 years ago this week, fighting breaks out on the streets of Chicago and inside the Democratic National Convention.
Fellow delegates, the people of America are watching us now, as indeed the whole world is watching us.
The convention itself was a boiling cauldron, both inside and outside the place.
How one night changed the trajectory of American politics. That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. It's Friday, which means Week in Review. And we start with the statewide primaries just 4 days away now. This week, candidates made their final push. City Councilor Ayanna Pressley says the 7th District needs new congressional leadership.
Having a progressive voting record in the most progressive seat in the country is not a profile in courage.
10-term incumbent Michael Capuano disagrees.
This campaign should be about what can you do for this district tomorrow once we get elected.
And in the race for the Secretary of the Commonwealth, the gloves are off for challenger Josh Zakim and incumbent Bill Galvin.
No show Zakim. He doesn't bother to vote. Let's not vote for him.
Zakim hits back.
For nearly 40 years in office, he's betrayed our core values.
Then there's also the 1st District, the 3rd District, the Governor's Office, and the AG. Lots to chew on. Joining me now in studio for their analysis of these races and the rest of the week's local news is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hi, Michael.
Hey, glad to be here.
And also with us is Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Great to have you back as well, Ed.
Thanks for having me back.
So we're going to start in the 7th District and we'll move out from there. Michael, I know that you have said you are a supporter of Ayanna Pressley. Let's start with why that is.
Yeah, so, and I've often said this, I'm a fan of Congressman Capuano's and the work he's done around the Fairmont Line, the work he's done for community health centers in the state, and I do work in the community health center space, so I know the investments he's had in community health centers. But this comes down to, for me, is about access and equity. And this is a young African-American woman with more talent and a pretty impressive resume in terms of her government experience running for a seat that, quite frankly, we've never had a person of color in. If we claim we want diversity, then they're going to sometimes run against blue, not just red. And in this case, this is Ayanna running for a seat that, quite frankly, is a minority-majority district. And we worked it that way, the redistricting folks, a few years ago. And it's an opportunity for her to take that seat. I think she's fabulous. She's phenomenal. And Congressman Capuano will have to earn his right to go back. And she'll have to present why she'll provide a different perspective and a different energy and focus.
Now, his response to that is obviously that he has more experience. He has a higher seniority ranking. Should he go back to Congress? How do you respond to that?
You know, it's always silly to me because it's the quintessential diversity conversation, right? Is every time you take a white man out of a seat, there's going to be two steps back to take 10 steps forward, right? Is that you're going to be unseating someone who comes in with more experience, who's been there longer. He's done amazing things. He's done great things. But the reality is she has to present her vision, and I think she has done that, of the issues that she'll focus on that, quite frankly, aren't necessarily his lane, his focus. And if she resonates with voters, they'll show up. And I think if many black and brown voters show up, this will be just like what we saw happen in New York.
So, Ed, you're a Republican activist. I'm curious to get your thoughts when you see a Democrat going after an incumbent like that.
Well, I mean, he was my congressman for several years. I think for a Democrat, he's been fine. And when I lived in Boston, I did not have time to run against him. I think he seems to have been a good man in Congress. And it's true that black women need more representation in Congress. Don't forget that they were the key voting group that saved America from Roy Moore. I think we owe them a little something extra for that, don't we? So I do think there are fundamental questions of justice. That is it fair to Michael Capuano? that he has to leave his seat to let an African-American woman into Congress. I agree with Michael that we can't wait till the white men are finished using up their seats. Although it's tragic, I think that America has whole time zones full of white male congressmen. I'd like to see replaced by Presley. It seems like he's like the number 300th guy. I think anything in the mountain time zone, I would support Presley. So it's just tragic. I was listening to the debate that WBR sponsored. I thought, my goodness, this may be the only white man in Congress she can't beat. Just because that she was excellent, but he was invincible. So my Democrat and unenrolled friends will vote in the primary. You have a very hard choice to make, but I think it is a very critical choice about justice and race in America and what you think is right. And if you don't think that Anna Presley should be in that seat, you have to deal with people like Michael who have been working for justice his entire life and tell him why he's wrong. And that's right. A very hard burden to meet.
Is there anything concrete-wise, policy-wise, that you can point to that would be a difference between the two? Or is it just simple as who's in that seat?
Well, I think for both of us who worked in this space and watch what happens in government, people bring different passions to different issues, right? You know, whether it's the opioid crisis, she comes from an abused background, so she'll bring in a different awareness to people of color, and I say people of color, but also poor white community issues of poverty, of drugs, of crime, of opportunity, right? The opportunity gaps, the equity issues that exist. She'll bring a different perspective to that than I, quite frankly, Congressman Capuano can. And there are things, and again, I want to credit him. He is a champion, and to his point, Capuano is an elected official that gets an A on the NAACP report card every year. But this is about an opportunity for Ayanna to bring a different perspective to District 7, the 7th Congressional District. And I think she's articulated that well, women and girls issues, opportunities for communities of color, and I think she'll do a great job in it.
So I want to move across the aisle here into your territory, Ed. Governor Baker, whether he may admit it or not, has a primary challenger. I think it's interesting the approach he's taken. I want to play a quick cut from one of Governor Baker's ads.
Governor Charlie Baker's bipartisan leadership has taken Massachusetts to new heights.
We're creating more jobs than ever before, and we continue to be a state that leads because we have great people.
Integrity, leadership, results.
So pretty generic, doesn't reference opponent or Republican issues necessarily, just kind of values-based. I guess none of us are probably surprised that he's running this tactic against controversial Springfield pastor Scott Lively. Is he making a mistake, do you think, Ed? Is there any worry for him on Tuesday?
No, the worry isn't for him. The worry is for the rest of us. I think that Lively will probably get about a third of Republicans. I think most of those will be protest votes against his moderate style of governing. It'll be very disappointing that a man with so many character flaws and terrible views as the Reverend Scott Lively will get as many votes as he has on our side. I think his voters are profoundly alienated from our values and our politics here in Massachusetts, and it'll be very sad to see how many votes that he gets when plenty of people like me are going to go vote for Charlie Baker, not just because he's Charlie Baker, but because he has made an effort to accept and respect Massachusetts values in a way that Scott Lively is an opponent of all those values.
Governor Baker has been pretty clear about his distaste for President Trump and even neglected to meet with the vice president when he was in the area, whether it was a scheduling conflict or not. There are a million voters in Massachusetts who voted for Trump. What's going on in the Republican Party here, and is Governor Baker doing enough to address the right wing of his party?
His job is primarily to make sure that life is good for all the citizens of the Commonwealth, including Republicans. You're right, he doesn't spend a lot of time, at least in the public eye, dealing with partisan issues. I think Trump makes it harder for him to unite the party behind a constructive vision for the party. And every time that somebody who's for Trump pops up, whether it's Jeff Deal or to lesser degree Jeff Deal's opponents or Scott Lively, it makes it more difficult for him to explain to everyone the reality of our state politics and what can and can't be achieved here.
So there are two candidates running on the Democratic side. People may or may not know that. They have struggled for months now to get their names out there, Bob Massey and Jay Gonzalez. Why do you guys think that they are having such a hard time making even a blip on the radar?
I think it's always challenged. The incumbent always controls the space, right? The governor has access to the almost daily press conferences and news events. He's in the news both locally and nationally. He is a popular governor. I think we sometimes forget how popular he is across the country and even in the Commonwealth. So for Massey and Gonzalez, folks don't necessarily know their backgrounds. They don't know their names. I had a chance to work with Jay when he was in A&F, but he was a sort of a background guy in A&F. He did a lot of the work under the Patrick administration. But if you ask the average person, they wouldn't know who he was. So he's had some ground, and they've had some ground to cover to even get their names out. That's a huge feat for folks to overcome a governor like Charlie Baker.
Ed, what do you think? Either of these guys have a shot, whoever comes out the winner on Tuesday?
No. Because I think they have no chance, I will do all I can to point out that they are great citizens and good people and they're working hard, and I'll be as nice as possible because I can afford to do that.
And you never know. I think as we've seen play out in the last 2 years, polls, none of that can really guarantee. I'm always up for competitive elections, and I think that there's two Democrats running for the seat. I'm hoping that they both show up and they give Charlie Baker a good run.
So speaking of you never know, I think a lot of people in this state take it for granted that Elizabeth Warren is going to win her reelection campaign. There are three Republican candidates who are battling it out on Tuesday. Jeff Diehl has kind of presented himself as the pro-Trump candidate. You've got Beth Lindstrom, who's kind of the moderate experienced lane, and you've got John Kingston, who's playing the moderate business outsider kind of card. What do you guys make of that race?
I'll let Michael go first. It might be more positive than I am.
You know, it's a race that I think ultimately people aren't paying enough attention to, and I think we should. I don't know any of the candidates well, and I was hoping maybe you have some personal experience with them to speak to.
That's your party, Ed.
It is my party. I think
you can cry if you want to.
I think Elizabeth Warren is going to win. I think that it's very hard. I think she's sort of like Baker. I think that she is well-known. She's popular, not as popular as he is. There doesn't seem to be a case for replacing her based on what people in Massachusetts are thinking about. The same sort of consensus, well, the economy is good, our politics are stable. I think that applies to Senator Warren. And, of course, nobody looking at Washington, D.C. is going to say, geez, you know, we should get rid of the Democrat and add a Republican to this mix. I think that's not a very popular opinion in the state right now. It's not a good year for us on our side. Jeff Diehl appears to be leading from the little polling that we have. I think all of these people are sort of trying to be Trump light to different degrees. I mean, they should have been sort of Baker heavy instead of Trump light. But that's what our primary ended up producing. That that was a failure in our primary on our side. There should have been a Charlie Baker style Republican running the entire time. Unfortunately, that did not happen.
And just on Warren, I travel the country both in my NAACP and my community health center role. I can tell you she is popular across the country. I will go places and they'll ask me, do I know her? So I think, you know, she has a pretty sizable war chest, 200 million just in the last few, 2 million in the last few months, 56, 7, 8 million dollars in her war chest. That's a tremendous feat to try to beat her. And I think her popularity will help her.
So a lot of races, obviously, we can't get to them all. And you can find a full breakdown of all the races on our website, radioboston.org. I just want to ask you guys quickly about one more race. The Secretary of State's race, which normally a real blah, nothing to see here kind of affair, has turned into maybe the nastiest race going on in the state. What's your take?
Well, you did say that the gloves have come off. I want you to know that I don't think that Secretary Galvin has ever put on gloves in his entire life. I think he's been a bare-knuckle brawler for quite a while now. So I think it was Zakin who decided to take his gloves off for this race. I think that I'm rooting for Zakin to win. I think we need a person of better character to be in that job. If he loses, of course, I'm hoping that Anthony Amore, my friend and the Republican candidate, will win. But let's just hope that Zakin can pull it off on Tuesday.
Yeah, I'm definitely pulling for Zakin, and I've worked with Galvin and his team. Calvin, who works for him, is a great guy. I think what it really comes down to is we want election reform, and we want to be a bold state that allows more people to have access to our voting and access to our democratic process. Zakin's promising to deliver that, and quite frankly, Galvin's been resistant to some of those changes. And that the time is now. So I think Zakim's call for us to step up on election reform will resonate with a lot of us that are younger voters.
All right. So we're going to put politics to the side here for a minute and shift gears a bit and talk about the Catholic Church.
Is that not politics also?
That's the greatest example of politics.
This week, Cardinal Sean O'Malley held a prayer meeting with about 300 priests from the Archdiocese. Obviously, there are growing scandals within the church from the clergy sexual abuse. The meeting came after it was a very critical letter from a former Vatican diplomat accusing Pope Francis about knowing about and ignoring accusations of abuse. And we spoke with Robert Hotson, a former priest and head of Road to Recovery, which helps abuse survivors. He spoke with BUR this week.
Do you notice the beautiful words that the Pope spouts consistently? We apologize. We're appalled. We're astonished. We never have gotten a plan from Pope Francis about how to clean this up.
Also this week, you've got Walter Robinson, who led the spotlight team during its investigation of the Catholic Church. He's now calling on every attorney general in the country to basically subpoena the church and get records of criminal activities. Your overall reactions to the story?
Yeah, I mean, it's the greatest example of you can't defer to other people to police themselves. It's an inherent thing. And, you know, we talk about this in police departments, but it's true for churches as well, is when there are these types of abuses, there's a natural tendency to protect yourself, to protect your image, to protect the personalities that you have a direct relationship with. I think it is a bold move that we need for attorney generals across the country to say, no, we want to take this out of your hands. We want to investigate. We want records. We want to investigate because, quite frankly, we can't leave it to our faith leaders to step up in this way.
Ed, I know you're a practicing Catholic.
I'm a lifelong Catholic. I was an altar boy during the time of all this, though I fortunately did not see that. It was very hard during the family mass that I take my children to have the priest talk about these things. It was very difficult. But the only thing worse would have been him not talking about it.
Right.
For all those of us who are Boston Catholics who went through this 15 years ago, this is like being told that a cancer you thought you beat has come back. That's how it felt to all of us out there. I certainly support the proposal that you mentioned to have attorneys general. I think it should be like a nationwide task force with a clearinghouse involved. I don't think you should leave it up to an individual attorney general's office to figure out the practices and the way to do this. I think it should be a national effort. I don't think the church should fear that. It sounds like these cases are mostly in the past, so I think it's better to just clear it up. And I do agree with Michael. I think it's time for the church to accept outsiders doing a lot of things to them. I want to see more lay people in the hierarchy. I'd like to see a couple of women cardinals be appointed, since the cardinals don't have to be priests or men, although that hasn't happened recently. I'd like to see that kind of change. I want to see more lay people to be injected into a church that does not want to see them. As you say, I think the police is a great example, that we can trust somebody and think they are the authority, but we have to say, I'm sorry, but we can't let you police yourself. I think that was a great example.
And just to add to that, I think it has to be an international effort. This is not just the United States. These abuses are happening at churches across the globe, and we should try to connect with other law enforcement agencies across the world and see if we can hold these churches accountable.
What about the call for all bishops in the country to step down? Do you think that's an appropriate step?
That sounds like a knee-jerk reaction. I understand that anger, and I think when you see the hierarchy, I think that's like somebody having a victim of a crime having a kind of an over-the-top reaction to what would be justice. I think that we have to calm down and listen to wiser people and go for deep reforms rather than something that would sort of make us feel good that might not be the answer.
Totally agree.
Yeah. All right, finally, I want to take a couple of minutes here to remember Arizona Senator John McCain, who died this past weekend from an aggressive form of brain cancer. It was actually the same type of cancer that claimed the life of his longtime friend and colleague in the Senate, Edward Kennedy. McCain's body is now lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Vice President Mike Pence spoke on behalf of the Trump administration at the service. Senator McCain did not want Trump at his funeral remembrances, but did ask for both former Presidents George W. Bush and Obama to eulogize him. We actually spoke with Mrs. Vicki Kennedy, the widow of Ted Kennedy, this week on the show. Here's what she had to say about Senator McCain.
I was struck in the last year where John declared from the floor of the Senate that all of the proudest and most satisfying moments in his career were when he worked with colleagues on both sides of the aisle. And it was that kind of leadership and that kind of willingness to bridge differences that I think was such a hallmark of his career and something that brought him and Teddy together.
So I just wanted to give you guys a chance to share your thoughts and reactions.
Yeah, I kind of jump in first. I think I've been frustrated and angered all week at our president, and I'm always angered and frustrated with him. But I think this whole issue with McCain's passing and his pettiness around the lowering of the flag, the making of the appropriate comments, just shows again to me how sad it is that we have a man who sits in that Oval Office that doesn't respect the seat. I got to go back to the voters who vote for him and who continue to stubbornly support him. Shame on you. If you still complain about people taking a knee and you claim that you want a person who sits in that seat who will be a good role model for your children, that man is embarrassing this country. And quite frankly, the fact that he did not show the appropriate respect for Senator McCain, who I did not agree with on many issues, but that's what you do when you're president. You show respect for the passing of a man who gave his life in service to this country. And he did not do that until it was too late. And he did it sort of half-ass. And that's troubling for many of us who believe that he is a horrible president who hopefully will be impeached one day.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I think he mattered. I have many stories about McCain, but my two favorite moments with him is one when, you know, America was in Iraq and there was a revelation that we were perhaps embracing torture overseas, and how clearly he spoke to say, no, it's wrong. that we can't torture people. That cannot be our policy. And he had a moral authority to say, when we were being tortured in Vietnam, we looked at each other and said, but we wouldn't do this. That was a great moment in American politics. And the other moment I think of him was at the end of the hasty, sloppy, last-ditch attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, that there was John McCain, a terminally ill man, reaching out his arm and giving a thumbs down in front of Mitch McConnell and saying, no, we're not doing this, and it ended it. That was one of the greatest moments I've ever seen in American politics, that he stood up there. And honestly, if there's a statue of him, I hope the statue is of him giving the thumbs down to say that there are moral principles that matter, and you have no leverage over me, and I'm going to show you what the right thing is. So I think of that and say, wow, he was a giant.
And on the campaign trail, when he challenged the woman who had a perception of Barack Obama that was a racist, fabricated perception, and he challenged that woman. I think that just showed the character of the man.
Yeah, it's so easy at a rally like that to kind of just go along with whatever's being said and to stop it, to call that out. I think a lot of people remember that as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
So we've dealt with a lot of heavy stuff. I want to end on a little bit of a lighter note here. So we've got just enough time left to do some quick hubbubs, brief stories or events that caught your attention this week. Michael, let's start with you.
Well, I'm going to defer because I didn't have a hubbub for this week. So I'd rather react to my colleagues here at the hubbub.
All right. Fair enough.
So mine is a good one, but I think I'm sure Michael could articulate it more, that David Bernstein wrote this week in WGBH that analysis of the past couple of cycles shows that minority candidates are finally raising big amounts of money and operating powerful social networks in order to be able to make credible campaigns, and showing that a lot of people of color are raising a lot of money even for state legislative races, and how this is a big development for people of color. I'll let Michael kind of riff off of that, how significant that is.
The diversity in these candidates, the money that's being raised, I think we're finally cracking open the door. You got a Muslim woman, you got a young attorney, you got a transgender candidate, you got a little bit of everything. And it's true diversity, right? And I think we're finally at a place where democracy is now being welcoming all of us to the table. And I always remember that phrase, if you're not at the table, you're on the table, on the menu, more people are being invited.
All right. Well, mine is a lot less important than any of the other stuff we've talked about. But I had to say, Chad Finn did an explainer for Dennis Eckersley slang. It's linked on the Globe website. If you watch the Red Sox game, Dennis Eckersley in the booth has been one of the best parts of that broadcast. Such phrases as cheese, educated cheese, salad, educated salad, hair, which is actually referring to a fastball and its movement, moss, which is actually referring to the hair on your head, branch work and falling out of your tree, iron lamb, parachutes, lots of great stuff. Dennis Eckersley, a great addition to the Red Sox broadcast, so that's my hope. Well, that's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thank you both so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming in. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. 50 years ago this week, violence erupted in the streets of Chicago as Democrats from around the country gathered to nominate their presidential candidate. Protesters had converged on the city all week long to oppose the Democratic Party's total disregard of the anti-war candidates and the party establishment set on the nomination of then-Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who at that point still supported the Vietnam War. Tensions were high, and on the evening of August 28th, as 2,600 official delegates crowded inside the convention hall, they boiled over.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
What are you trying to strong-arm stuff? He's an elected delegate.
The Chicago police are now in the aisles here with billy clubs, clearing people out. They're not using them on people. They're carrying them, and they're dragging everybody right out of the aisle here. It's a terrific crush.
Anger and frustration exploded in the streets outside the convention as police brutally clashed with protesters. 89 million Americans watched the chaotic scene unfold on television.
A girl being carried off to a paddy wagon. Now and then there was another one, a bottle being thrown by the crowd. And the police clearing off the sidewalks in front of the Hilton. And the persistent chanting by the crowd, the whole world is watching. A
has said.
It was a night that had long-term political consequences and changed the trajectory of the country forever. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Governor Michael Dukakis, who was there that night as a young state representative. But first, to lay out the history and give us some context, David Shribman joins us on the line from Pittsburgh. He's executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe, where he had a piece published this week entitled Chicago 1968, When It All Changed. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
Well, thank you.
So I want to get to the big picture context in a moment, but I first want to start with kind of a snapshot of what that weekend was like. So if you could describe the scene of Chicago 1968 Democratic Convention, what was unfolding?
Well, first of all, the whole world was watching, and that was the taunt and the chant of the protesters who were basically being beaten by the police. There was a riot there, and you might call it a police riot. You might call more so than the student protest riot. And there were as many as 100,000 people gathered in Chicago protesting the war, expressing concern about the Democratic Party as it was about to nominate Hubert Humphrey, who had been the vice president, to Lyndon Johnson, who would become the bête noire of students and many other Democrats who opposed the Vietnam War. And so this was basically a siege, and it was a staging ground for protest and also a display of force by the Chicago police, who were basically ordered to do so by the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, Richard Daley. And it was a conflict of culture as well as of force. These were diametrically opposed groups in so many dimensions. They had very little in common, except they were all members of the human race. And so what we had basically was just after the Soviet troops and tanks had rolled into Prague, we had police in the street of the United States, of Chicago. It's at the time second most important city, second biggest city. And it was basically a spectacle and a horrible one.
So you mentioned Chicago Mayor Richard Daley there. As you said, he did say that some of the police may have overreacted, but placed the blame on the protesters. I want to play a little bit of tape that we've got. Here's Mayor Daley.
Our administration and the people of Chicago have never and will condone brutality at any time, but they will never permit a lawless, violent group of terrorists to menace the lives of millions of people, destroy the purpose of this national convention, and take over the streets of Chicago.
Can you talk a little bit more about the role that Mayor Daley played in all of this?
Well, he was basically the commander-in-chief of that army of police, and also they were supplemented by National Guard and state police, of course. But it's funny to hear that word terrorist in 1968. We now know what terrorists can do in the United States in a much different context 50 years later. It seems so antiquarian, his use of that phrase. But Mayor Daley really was the symbol of the old Democratic Party that these protesters were protesting. And the great irony here, Chris, is that in a law and order city, anarchy reigned. And it was really a conflict of ways to look at the world and to conduct politics.
So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about some of the context leading up to that weekend in Chicago. As you mentioned, the country is bitterly divided over the war in Vietnam. Just months before the convention takes place, the country watched the assassinations of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Can you talk a little bit about the mood of the country at that time? How were people dealing with all that turmoil?
Well, there was also conflict in the cities over racial issues. There was a Republican nominating process that had at the start Governor Rockefeller of New York and Governor Romney, Mitt Romney's father, of Michigan. They swiftly were eclipsed by Richard Nixon, who was supposed to have been a dead man walking politically. At the same time, the Democrats went through a huge identity crisis. They were the putative head of the party, of course, was the President of the United States. And he was repudiated as early as early March in New Hampshire when Eugene McCarthy came in second in the presidential New Hampshire primary, but actually won it because he beat the expectations there. So President Johnson was in retreat and on the defense. And we remember, of course, on March 31st, he withdrew from the nomination fight. I think he had, Chris, the notion that this nomination fight in Chicago would come to some kind of impasse, and the party would turn to its loyal, to its old warrior, the president, but that never happened. Another interesting thing about this convention was it occurred during the 60th birthday of the president, and he expected to be feted at that convention, and he didn't dare go there.
So, as you say, the Democrats went on to nominate Vice President Hubert Humphrey. He'd supported the Vietnam War. I want to play a quick clip from Vice President Humphrey's acceptance speech that night.
Yet one cannot help but reflect the deep sadness that we feel over the troubles and the violence which have erupted regrettably and tragically in the streets of this great city, and for the personal injuries which have occurred.
He went on to say that violence breeds counter-violence and cannot be condoned no matter the source. In your piece, you called him the biggest tragic figure of Chicago 1968. Can you talk a little bit about how he was affected by the events that weekend?
Well, don't forget, he had been the bright light of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party since 1948. At another convention, 40 years earlier, he gave the most remarkable speech imaginable when he said that the Democratic Party had to come out of the shadows of segregation into the bright light of racial integration. He was a liberal warrior, the likes of which we very rarely see. He gave John Kennedy a hard time in the 1960 election. He took reluctantly the vice presidency in 64. And so by the time he gets to the convention, he's basically been co-opted by Lyndon Johnson, even though the better angels of his nature might have cited him elsewhere. And so he's sitting there in Chicago, and he's hiding in his own shower to stay away from the tear gas. He gives a speech to a convention that's embattled and to a party that's divided, and he knows he's doomed. He knows he's doomed. He almost pulls it out at the end. He separates by the end of September with Johnson on the war, but it's probably a little bit too late. But in any case, if it lasted an extra week, he might have beaten Richard Nixon. But presidential elections, except in the year 2000, don't go into overtime.
It's crazy to think back. What if the Washington Post characterized his victory speech at the convention as the one that nobody remembers?
Right. People remember actually the one that McGovern gave 4 years later when he lost 49 states, when he said, "Come home, America." But they don't remember this one.
Do you think there's anything Humphrey could have said or done at that point, or was he just doomed from the moment he took that stage?
Well, he didn't dare break from Johnson. He was afraid of what that would happen. He was in the world's worst pickle. Walter Mondale, who was with him, watched this, said that he was just torn apart inside and outside.
You also wrote that there was really only one winner that night, Richard Nixon. He went on, obviously, to win the presidential election that year. Can you talk about how much the events of that weekend actually impacted Nixon's rise?
Well, sure. He had sent, not as a spy, but kind of as a surveillance officer, the young Patrick J. Buchanan, whom, of course, would run for president two times later and who is well-known as a commentator today and as a pugilistic columnist, kind of as a surveillance officer, as we say. And he reported back to Nixon that this is chaos here. Nixon already had planned to speak in Chicago shortly after the convention. This all of a sudden became a great opportunity to talk about law and order. Nixon ran a law and order campaign. This was at the same time he was making inroads in the South with the Southern strategy. It changed all of American politics. Today, of course, the solid South is Republican, but he helped transform the South into a solid Republican bloc. Everything began to change.
So Nixon ran that law and order campaign, really kind of used the events of that weekend as an example.
Sure.
Looking back, do you think that there's anything the Democratic Party could have done differently to kind of prevent the chaos and the violence of that weekend? Or was this just simply a powder keg that was going to explode one way or another?
Well, this was a powder keg that was going to explode. But, of course, we forget the fights about women and minorities in the party. That was all resolved and rectified. And, you know, the party that met in Miami Beach in 1972 was a much different party. McGovern joked that he helped open the doors to the party, and as he said, he opened the doors and 20 million people walked out. But the party was changed substantially. It's much more like the party we know today, and fewer influences of the bosses. We saw this actually in the last couple of weeks when the Democratic Party reasserted its impulse to repel bosses from the party. It changed the way the party nominates candidates, and in response, the Republican Party changed as well. You know, it began to have more primaries, fewer caucuses. The bosses were less influential. The party of the establishment, as we now know, the Republicans, is now an anti-establishment party. That was set in motion as well.
So then one final question. We're talking about all this. I can't help but think back to the Democratic Convention of 2016, where you had a sizable chunk of delegates in the room who were upset with the process and the nominee. You had progressives who were expressing frustration with the establishment's approach, saying it's not proactive enough. Do you see any echoes in the Democratic Party of today compared to 1968?
Well, Chris, I think the Democrats are a lot more reluctant to embrace their 2016 candidate now than they were, you know, back in the summer of 2016.
Fair enough.
So,
hindsight 2020.
Yeah, of course. But
there were disruptions in the room. There was
the Bernie element, and the Bernie element now is at the fore. I think those tensions have always been with the Democratic Party since 1932. The Democratic Party before that was really the party of stasis, very boring, small government, a little bit more than a little bit racist. Democratic Party's tensions now tend to play out in public in a way they didn't before 1932, I don't think. But let's also agree that the Republicans have those kinds of tensions too. There's the surge of the insurgents under Trump, and then there's the establishment, which identifies with the Bush wing, with a more traditional Republicanism. You have this now in both parties. You have it in stereo.
That's David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Stay with us. Coming up, Governor Michael Dukakis, who was there when the chaos broke out on the convention floor that night in Chicago 50 years ago this week. I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. 50 years ago this week, violence erupted in the streets of Chicago as Democrats from around the country gathered to nominate their presidential candidate. Protesters had converged on the city all week long to oppose the Democratic Party's total disregard of the anti-war candidates and the party establishment set on the nomination of then-Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who at that point still supported the Vietnam War. Tensions were high, and on the evening of August 28th, as 2,600 official delegates crowded inside the convention hall, they boiled over.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Ryan.
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
What are you trying to strong-arm stuff? He's an elected delegate.
The Chicago police are now in the aisles here with billy clubs, clearing people out. They're not using them on people. They're carrying them, and they're dragging everybody right out of the aisle here. It's a terrific crush.
Anger and frustration exploded in the streets outside the convention as police brutally clashed with protesters. 89 million Americans watched the chaotic scene unfold on television.
A girl being carried off to a paddy wagon. Now and then there was another one, a bottle being thrown by the crowd. And the police clearing off the sidewalks in front of the Hilton. And the persistent chanting by the crowd, "The whole world is watching," they say.
It was a night that had long-term political consequences and changed the trajectory of the country forever. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Governor Michael Dukakis, who was there that night as a young state representative. But first, to lay out the history and give us some context, David Shribman joins us on the line from Pittsburgh. He's executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe, where he had a piece published this week entitled Chicago 1968, When It All Changed. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
Well, thank you.
So I want to get to the big picture context in a moment, but I first want to start with kind of a snapshot of what that weekend was like. So if you could describe the scene of Chicago 1968 Democratic Convention, what was unfolding?
Well, first of all, the whole world was watching, and that was the taunt and the chant of the protesters who were basically being beaten by the police. There was a riot there, and you might call it a police riot. You might call more so than the student protest riot. And there were as many as 100,000 people gathered in Chicago protesting the war, expressing concern about the Democratic Party as it was about to nominate Hubert Humphrey, who had been the vice president, to Lyndon Johnson, who would become the bête noire of students and many other Democrats who opposed the Vietnam War. And so this was basically a siege, and it was a staging ground for protest and also a display of force by the Chicago police, who were basically ordered to do so by the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, Richard Daley. And it was a conflict of culture as well as of force. These were diametrically opposed groups in so many dimensions. They had very little in common, except they were all members of the human race. And so what we had basically was just after the Soviet troops and tanks had rolled into Prague, we had police in the street of the United States, of Chicago. It's, at the time, second most important city, second biggest city. And it was basically a spectacle and a horrible one.
So you mentioned Chicago Mayor Richard Daley there. As you said, he did say that some of the police may have overreacted, but placed the blame on the protesters. I want to play a little bit of tape that we've got. Here's Mayor Daley.
Our administration and the people of Chicago have never and will condone brutality at any time, but they will never permit a lawless, violent group of terrorists to menace the lives of millions of people, destroy the purpose of this national convention, and take over the streets of Chicago.
Can you talk a little bit more about the role that, that Mayor Daley played in all of this?
Well, he was basically the commander-in-chief of that army of police, and also they were supplemented by National Guard and state police, of course. But it's funny to hear that word terrorist in 1968. We now know what terrorists can do in the United States in a much different context 50 years later. It seems so antiquarian, his use of that phrase. But Mayor Daley really was the symbol of the old Democratic Party that these protesters were protesting. And the great irony here, Chris, is that in a law and order city, anarchy reigned. And it was really a conflict of ways to look at the world and to conduct politics.
So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about some of the context leading up to that weekend in Chicago. As you mentioned, the country is bitterly divided over the war in Vietnam. Just months before the convention takes place, the country watched the assassinations of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Can you talk a little bit about the mood of the country at that time? How were people dealing with all that turmoil?
Well, there was also conflict in the cities over racial issues. There was a Republican nominating process that had at the start Governor Rockefeller of New York and Governor Romney, Mitt Romney's father, of Michigan. They swiftly were eclipsed by Richard Nixon, who was supposed to have been a dead man walking politically. At the same time, the Democrats went through a huge identity crisis. They were the putative head of the party, of course, was the President of the United States. And he was repudiated as early as early March in New Hampshire when Eugene McCarthy came in second in the presidential New Hampshire primary, but actually won it because he beat the expectations there. So President Johnson was in retreat and on the defense. And we remember, of course, on March 31st, he withdrew from the nomination fight. I think he had, Chris, the notion that this nomination fight in Chicago would come to some kind of impasse and the party would turn to its loyal, to its old warrior, the president, but that never happened. Another interesting thing about this convention was it occurred during the 60th birthday of the president, and he expected to be feted at that convention, and he didn't dare go there.
So as you say, the Democrats went on to nominate Vice President Hubert Humphrey. He'd supported the Vietnam War. I want to play a quick clip from Vice President Humphrey's acceptance speech that night.
Yet one cannot help but reflect the deep sadness that we feel over the troubles and the violence which have erupted, regrettably and tragically, in the streets of this great city, and for the personal injuries which have occurred.
He went on to say that violence breeds counter-violence and cannot be condoned no matter the source. In your piece, you called him the biggest tragic figure of Chicago 1968. Can you talk a little bit about how he was affected by the events that weekend?
Well, don't forget, he had been the bright light of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party since 1948. At another convention, 40 years earlier, he gave the most remarkable speech imaginable when he said that the Democratic Party had to come out of the shadows of segregation into the bright light of racial integration. He was a liberal warrior, the likes of which we very rarely see. He gave John Kennedy a hard time in the 1960 election. He took reluctantly the vice presidency in 64. And so by the time he gets to the convention, he's basically been co-opted by Lyndon Johnson, even though the better angels of his nature might have cited him elsewhere. And so he's sitting there in Chicago, and he's hiding in his own shower to stay away from the tear gas. He gives a speech to a convention that's embattled and to a party that's divided, and he knows he's doomed. He knows he's doomed. He almost pulls it out at the end. He separates by the end of September with Johnson on the war, but it's probably a little bit too late. But in any case, if it lasted an extra week, he might have beaten Richard Nixon. But presidential elections, except in the year 2000, don't go into overtime.
It's crazy to think back. What if the Washington Post characterized his victory speech at the convention as the one that nobody remembers?
Right. People remember actually the one that McGovern gave 4 years later when he lost 49 states, when he said, "Come home, America." But they don't remember this one.
Do you think there's anything Humphrey could have said or done at that point, or was he just doomed from the moment he took that stage?
Well, he didn't dare break from Johnson. He was afraid of what that would happen. He was in the world's worst pickle. Walter Mondale, who was with him, watched this, said that he was just torn apart inside and outside.
You also wrote that there was really only one winner that night, Richard Nixon. He went on, obviously, to win the presidential election that year. Can you talk about how much the events of that weekend actually impacted Nixon's rise?
Well, sure. He had sent, not as a spy, but kind of as a surveillance officer, the young Patrick J. Buchanan, whom, of course, would run for president two times later and who is well known as a commentator today and as a pugilistic columnist, kind of as a surveillance officer, as we say. And he reported back to Nixon that this is chaos here. Nixon already had planned to speak in Chicago shortly after the convention. This all of a sudden became a great opportunity to talk about law and order. Nixon ran a law and order campaign. This was at the same time he was making inroads in the South with the Southern strategy. It changed all of American politics. Today, of course, the solid South is Republican, but he helped transform the South into a solid Republican bloc. Everything began to change.
So Nixon ran that law and order campaign, really kind of used the events of that weekend as an example.
Sure.
Looking back, do you think that there's anything the Democratic Party could have done differently to kind of prevent the chaos and the violence of that weekend? Or was this just simply a powder keg that was going to explode one way or another?
Well, this was a powder keg that was going to explode. But, of course, we forget the fights about women and minorities in the party. That was all resolved and rectified. And, you know, the party that met in Miami Beach in 1972 was a much different party. McGovern joked that he helped open the doors to the party, and as he said, he opened the doors and 20 million people walked out. But the party was changed substantially. It's much more like the party we know today, and fewer influences of the bosses. We saw this actually in the last couple of weeks when the Democratic Party reasserted its impulse to repel bosses from the party. It changed the way the party nominates candidates, and in response, the Republican Party changed as well. You know, it began to have more primaries, fewer caucuses. The bosses were less influential. The party of the establishment, as we now know, the Republicans, is now an anti-establishment party. That was set in motion as well.
So then one final question. We're talking about all this. I can't help but think back to the Democratic Convention of 2016, where you had a sizable chunk of delegates in the room who were upset with the process and the nominee. You had progressives who were expressing frustration with the establishment's approach, saying it's not proactive enough. Do you see any echoes in the Democratic Party of today compared to 1968?
Well, Chris, I think the Democrats are a lot more reluctant to embrace their 2016 candidate now than they were, you know, back in the summer of 2016.
Fair enough.
So,
hindsight 2020.
Yeah, of course. But
there were disruptions in the room. There was
The Bernie element, and the Bernie element now is at the fore. I think those tensions have always been with the Democratic Party since 1932. The Democratic Party before that was really the party of stasis, very boring, small government, a little bit more than a little bit racist. Democratic Party's tensions now tend to play out in public in a way they didn't before 1932, I don't think. But let's also agree that the Republicans have those kinds of tensions too. There's the surge of the insurgents under Trump, and then there's the establishment, which identifies with the Bush wing, with a more traditional Republicanism. You have this now in both parties. You have it in stereo.
That's David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis was there in Chicago as a young state representative, and we reached out to him for a firsthand account of what it was like. Governor Dukakis, welcome to Radio Boston.
Happy to be with you.
Governor, you were there that night in Chicago when the violence broke out outside the convention hall. Why were you there, and can you set the scene for us? Tell us what happened.
I can't remember exactly whether I was a delegate or an alternate, but I was part of the delegation. And needless to say, it was a very, very tough and very tense time for a lot of reasons. First, President Kennedy's assassination, troubles over the Vietnam War and what was going on at the time, the Civil Rights Revolution, and it was all happening simultaneously, and the convention itself was a boiling cauldron, both inside and outside the place. So it was an interesting time to be there, but a very tough time.
Yeah, ultimately 650 people were arrested, 100 protesters, 49 police officers treated for injuries. Did you see any of the commotion outside at all, or were you inside
the
hall?
Well, most of us who were delegates didn't see it because we were basically in the convention all day long for several days.
Right.
We were certainly hearing about it and watching it on our television sets at night. And for reasons I'm not sure I understood, the demonstrators or somebody decided to go at some of the hotels, and I remember the distinct odor of what I guess were mothballs that had been set on fire and gave off a terrible odor as we came back to the hotel after another one of these very tough days. But inside the convention hall wasn't fun either. As a matter of fact, on one of the evenings, one of the important evenings, I found a Chicago sanitation man sitting in my seat who looked as if he had just come off the truck. And apparently these were folks that Mayor Daley kind of invited to occupy the convention hall. So I said to him, I said, "Sorry, but I'm Mike Dukakis. I'm a state rep from Massachusetts, and I think you're in my seat." And he was nice enough about leaving, but it gives you some sense of what was going on even inside the place. And then, of course, we had the mayor himself, when Governor Ribicoff was speaking, going after him with a vicious anti-Semitic remark. It wasn't fun inside. Obviously, it was much tougher and worse outside.
Yeah, you're talking about Connecticut Governor Ribicoff.
Yeah, right.
So you talked about it a little bit in that first answer, but if you can kind of bring us back to 1968, the country's in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, dealing with the Vietnam War. What was it like?
In a very divided Democratic Party, needs to say, we had an incumbent president who was a terrific domestic president, but got us involved in this Vietnam War, which was not going well and dividing the country in a very profound way. I mean, young people in particular opposed to it, older folks to some extent staying with it. There was enormous anger and enormous resentment. And when you put the civil rights movement into that, and profound changes going on, especially in the South, but all over the country, the passage of three major civil rights laws over a period of 4 or 5 years, and then to top it off, first the assassination of a president in 63, then the split within the Democratic Party, Bobby Kennedy's candidacy along with Gene McCarthy's, and then the assassination of Kennedy and Martin Luther King within a relatively short period of time. I mean, it was a very, very difficult time.
Can you talk a little bit about, specifically here in Boston, what was the political, social fabric like here?
Well, we were facing exactly the same pressures and tensions and anger elsewhere. Remember, we had our own problems here. I grew up in the town of Brookline, where until the late 60s or early 70s, a person of color couldn't live in the town of Brookline. We had literally three African-American families lived in the town. Two were janitors who lived in basements with their families. And then a renowned tenor who somehow found somebody who was willing to sell him a house, what we call Pill Hill. That was it. If you were a person of color, you just didn't live in towns like Brookline.
So you have this kind of flashpoint event at the convention in 1968. How did that change the Democratic Party from there on?
Well, the Democratic Party, like all parties, I suppose, evolved and evolves. Remember, it was Franklin Roosevelt who was the great change agent when it came to the Democratic Party and turned it into a strong progressive force. It hadn't been that up until that time. It was badly divided. We had a lot of Southerners in the Congress who called themselves Democrats who were racist, very conservative. And so that whole upheaval was taking place at the same time. But parties evolve. Of course, at that time, you had conservatives and Democrats in both parties. And there were political scientists at the time, I remember, who I studied in college, saying this is ridiculous. The parties ought to stand for something. Parties ought to have a distinct philosophy so people know what they're voting for. Well, the critics got their wish, right? And now we have two parties which are really about as divided ideologically as I can recall in my lifetime. And people say, what's the matter? Why can't these folks get along? Who are the consensus builders and so on and so forth? So, that's what makes politics interesting, but awfully difficult at times. And it certainly was then, I can tell you.
Richard Nixon ran a campaign that had a strong note of law and order as a recurring theme, and kind of used the events of the 68 convention as an example of what he was supposedly fighting against. Do you think that what happened that weekend played into Richard Nixon's rise?
No question about it. And there was a strong element of race there, too. You know, Nixon peddled this notion that there was a silent majority that were opposed to this kind of stuff and opposed to these liberal demands and so forth. And no question, race played a major role in that.
Do you think the party should have done anything differently that weekend? Was there any way to prevent the unbelievable scene that unfolded?
I don't know at the time, but I can tell you that if Hubert Humphrey had come out against the Vietnam War about a month earlier than he did, he'd have been elected president of the United States, so we'd have never had Nixon in the White House, we'd have never had an impeachment or a near impeachment. We'd have gotten out of the war. I mean, all kinds of coulda, woulda, shouldas, but yeah. It just didn't happen.
So you've talked a couple of times about some of the parallels between what the party and the country was facing in 1968 and what it's facing today. Can you kind of expand on the today's Democratic Party and any connection you see with the situation in 68?
The party is a lot more unified in terms of what it stands for. That doesn't mean that we don't have elements within the party that want to move faster or slower or whatever. But you certainly don't have a large chunk of the party, and especially its congressional representation, which is openly racist and very conservative at the same time. And those were the Southern Democrats. Not only did they stand for those kinds of things, but they had great seniority in the Congress. So while you had a party that was struggling to turn itself into a much more progressive political organization, you had these folks who were real obstacles to change in the Congress, and it took a long time before that happened. Of course, Lyndon Johnson, when he signed the Civil Rights Act, said quite famously, at the time, there goes the South, and he was right. But it was the right thing to do. I mean, it did make a lot of sense to have, if you are striving to build a strong and progressive party, I mean, having these folks as your congressional leaders in Congress doesn't make a lot of sense. But it certainly created a lot of tension and a lot of controversy, and it's only now, really, that the Democrats are working to try to get the South back in many ways, and we're beginning to see that happen in places like Georgia and other places, but it's going to take some time.
You talked earlier about kind of how the parties have, in today's world, now have things that they actually stand for, certain ideologies. some of the analysis of the Democratic messaging is that it's too anti-Trump, it's not offering anything as a party. Do you think that there is something to be said for that?
I think that is not true. Look, this is all about saving American democracy. This isn't child's play here. We've got a guy in the White House who doesn't understand democracy and doesn't understand how you get things done in a way that involves people actively. He's a guy that seems to get his jollies from insulting people day after day after day. You know, and that's not the way you lift up a country and help us to feel good about ourselves and what we're doing. So we've got some very, very serious months ahead of us. But the wonderful thing about democracy is that you can change it. And that's what a lot of us are doing, everything we can to do. And I hope and expect that we're first going to have some good news in the congressional elections and then go on and elect ourselves a president who does understand what democracy is and how you build it and how you bring people together, and fairly confident that we can do that. But it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort.
So I just want to finish with a quote from John Meacham and get your reaction to it, talking about the convention in 68. Chicago 1968 is the political equivalent of Woodstock or Stonewall, a discrete moment that embodies the questions and forces of an entire age. Do you think that accurately reflects on that weekend?
Maybe a little exaggerated. You know, every one of these conventions is an important event and carries with it all kinds of possibilities as well as dangers. And having been in this political business for a long time now, I'm not sure it was that cataclysmic, but I will tell you it was tough, and it was the crossroads of a lot of things that were happening in the United States. I'm sorry we're in some ways back at that. I really thought we had made and have been making great progress, and a lot of this stuff was behind us. But it's obvious, especially with a guy in the White House, that it isn't, and it just means that good people that care deeply about the country, have just got to be deeply and actively involved, and that's happening. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of congressional seats that are being challenged, and I think that's a good thing. But in the last analysis, if you want to preserve and strengthen democracy, you got to get out there and be involved. And I do hope that lots and lots and lots of Americans are going to be doing that.
Well, that's former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. Governor Dukakis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Sidorick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Sidorick. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I hope you'll join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.